Song leading, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to also wish our best wishes to those who we hope are able to listen to us today with our live cast, and both those in Manhattan. We've got some in India also, I believe, that are able to still be doing that. We wish them all the best. And also, Josh, any of those that maybe are overseas in our own forces that are listening to us, we're glad to have you with us in that sense. Jesus was a masterful teacher. I think that goes without saying. There's a marvelous statement in Mark chapter 12, verse 37, that says, "The great crowd enjoyed listening to him." He was just interesting. In that particular context is where Jesus is in the temple, and he has been discussing, we might even use the term debating, with the religious leaders of his day, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. And Jesus would oh so deftly respond to their comments and their attempted entrapments, and he would parry all of their thrusts and would ultimately teach in such a dramatic way. And Mark 12, verse 37 says, "The great crowd enjoyed listening to him." Wouldn't Jesus have made a great entertainer? Wasn't he an interesting speaker? Didn't people just tend to hang on every word? Wasn't he a great storyteller? He told those marvelous parables. And those were really stories that had a lesson, but they were just interesting stories. And that's part of why the multitudes were so intrigued by Jesus, and why they wanted to come and listen to what he was saying to his disciples. And every now and then he would turn to the multitudes and he would say one of those marvelous parable stories. He was just interesting. Wouldn't he have made a great entertainer? We live in a day where we like to listen to entertaining speakers and comedians and stand-up comics. And there are some things Jesus said that are even a little bit humorous. I think people would have laughed when they heard him talk about somebody who's trying to get a speck out of somebody else's eye and there's a great big beam sticking out of his eyeball. I think that would have been humorous to people. I think when Jesus said of Herod, "Well, you go tell that fox," and then made his comment, I think people would have chuckled. Wouldn't Jesus have made a great entertainer? But yet that's not what he was about. He could have done that if he had wanted to. He could have attracted great crowds by means of the interesting things that he would say and the humorous things that he could come up with and the very intriguing mental kind of discussions that he could have engaged them in, both of a theological and a secular nature. But that's not what Jesus was about. Jesus did not come to this world to entertain people. Not that entertainment is wrong, but that's just not why Jesus came. That introduces what I'd like to talk with you about this morning. I want to start out this morning and talk with you about some things that Jesus did not do. Some things that are not bad things, not sinful things, no good things that Jesus could have done in his earthly ministry, but that Jesus did not do. And the first of those is entertain people, though, as we've said, he certainly, if he had wanted to, he could have been a very entertaining kind of person and appealed to people solely on that basis. And yet, when you look, not just at Mark 12 and verse 37, but also at John chapter 6, verses 60 and following, you there see where some of the things that Jesus had to teach people were far from entertaining. In fact, some of his own disciples said, "This is a hard statement. Who can listen to it?" And they withdrew, the text says, and were not following him anymore. And what is intriguing to me is that despite the fact that some of the things of what Jesus said were far from entertaining, instead had the opposite effect upon his audience, it didn't cause Jesus to change his message. It didn't cause him to somehow scratch what he had been talking about and say, well, listen, I'm sorry, folks, let me try again. And so the next day he came out and he had, you know, some new stories and some new interesting parables, and he would stop saying the things that the previous day had been so hard for people to hear. That's not what Jesus did. He could have been an entertainer, but that's not why he came to the world. Jesus could have settled legal disputes with great wisdom and great intellectual acumen. In fact, in Luke chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, one of the individuals from the crowd yelled out to Jesus at one point and said, "Master, make my brother divide the inheritance with me." We don't know all the details, but obviously there's some kind of a dispute between those siblings over the inheritance. The eldest brother in that Jewish society was the one who was in charge of the inheritance. You kind of get the impression that maybe this is some younger brother who didn't feel like that his older brother, who's the so-called executor of the estate, we might say, he wasn't being fair in his distribution of the family wealth. And so here's someone who says, "Jesus, settle this dispute." Couldn't Jesus have done that pretty well? I think so. In fact, unlike the judges in our court system, who are finite beings and don't really know all the facts and don't know who's being totally honest and who maybe is being deceptive, Jesus, with his special ability, could have just cut through all of that and discerned what the facts are in a far greater way than even King Solomon himself. But despite that, Jesus said to the man who had blurted that request out from the crowd, he said, "Man, who made me a judge and arbiter over you?" Kind of gave the man a rebuke, almost. Certainly made it very clear that that's not why I'm here. And if you've come because you see me as this great miracle worker and as someone with great wisdom, and so I could settle your legal dispute with your brother, that's not what I'm about. That's not why I'm here. I'll tell you something else Jesus could have done very well. He could have ended world poverty. Absolutely could have quelled it. In fact, in Matthew chapter 17, verse 27, there the text says that when it came time for those coming by demanding taxes for Caesar and the authorities there, and Jesus said, "Well, really, we don't need to pay this, but lest we offend." And he said to Peter, "Go throw a fish line in the water, and the first fish you pull out, there'll be a coin in his mouth. Be a shekel. Pay the tax." It's pretty good. That's a pretty good way. You don't have to go fishing all the time, but boy, if you're fishing and you get money as a result of that, Jesus could have produced a lot of money. In fact, here's the individual who's able to take five loaves and a couple of fish here and just feed 5,000 plus people. Imagine what he could have done with just a couple of shekels. Wow, just multiply that for everybody. Just distribute all that wealth. And I don't just mean to a bunch of greedy people. I mean to impoverished people. And there were a lot. In fact, Jesus in Luke chapter 21, verses 2 through 4, that marvelous story where Jesus is in the temple and is in the court of the women, and there's a widow who comes and she puts in her two mites into that temple treasury box. And Jesus watches her. And you recall what he said. You know, she's put in far greater wealth than all these wealthy people who've come in and given of their surplus. Jesus says she gave all that she had. It's a marvelous story, and Jesus commends this widow woman for giving literally, virtually all that she had to live on. And yet the text never says that Jesus went and helped that woman out monetarily. Never went up to that widow woman and said, "Listen, if you go fishing, the first fish you catch is going to be a shekel in its mouth." didn't give her any funds, didn't miraculously cause her to have any funds, didn't resolve her poverty. He commended her for her great character. He was obviously very much aware of her circumstances in life, as pitiful as they were. And yet he didn't do anything to help her. Could have, but didn't. He just commended her. That's what he did. Jesus could have ended all disease. I mean, look at all the miracles that Jesus is doing. Most of Jesus' miracles are miracles of healing. Matthew chapter 9 talks about how Jesus, as he's going throughout his Galilean ministry, he is healing all of those who would come to him and with all kinds of sicknesses, and some were demon-possessed with various ailments that were accompanying all that. He would heal all of those. And so imagine how Jesus could have, with his power, just wiped out disease in this world. But that's not what Jesus did. In fact, Mark chapter 6 and verse 5 indicates to us that there were some occasions when he would go to a town, if that town was not receptive of him, if they were not willing to accept his teaching, Jesus wouldn't do any miracles. That Mark says there's occasion where he couldn't do any miracles in that town. I don't think he means that he couldn't physically do a miracle. He just means that according to Jesus' policy, couldn't do any miracles in that town. Mark says he did heal a few people, but basically he didn't do what he normally did and just come in there and all the people that would bring their sick and he would heal them. Didn't do it. Purposely didn't do it because those people were not accepting his teaching. Jesus obviously put his teaching on a higher level of priority than the miraculous healings. In fact, the miraculous healings were really just something that were a means to an end of establishing that he really was teaching from God. And so if people were not accepting his teaching, he wasn't going to heal them. And there certainly were a lot of people throughout Palestine and throughout the world that Jesus never healed. Could have if he'd chosen to, but certainly never did. And a lot of social injustice that Jesus could have ended. A lot of oppressed people that Jesus could have delivered. In fact, in John chapter 18, verses 36 and 37, when Jesus is standing before Pilate, and Pilate has received news that Jesus is supposed to be some kind of a king, and he says, "Are you a king?" And Jesus acknowledges, "Yes, yes, I am a king." And if you think about that, imagine if Jesus were a political kind of king, the way the Jews were anticipating, imagine the kind of earthly ruler he could have been. Not only could Jesus have used his great power to deliver the Jews from the oppression of the Roman armies, and let me tell you what, the Roman armies and the Roman political powers, they did oppress the Jews. There were so many occasions in Jewish history where those Roman leaders would just, to quell some kind of uprising or to just put fear in the Jews' hearts, they'd take a group of Jews and crucify them and allow their bodies to just hang there and rot so everybody could see the power of Rome. Talk about an oppressed people. King Jesus could have reigned in Jerusalem on an earthly throne and could have ended that kind of oppression of those Jewish people. And not just those Jewish people. He could have delivered and conquered all of those social ills, all of those slaves oppressed by wicked masters, all those who were in some kind of difficult circumstance politically or economically or whatever the prejudice of that day that was somehow against them, and all the unfairness and all of that. He could have, as a king, as a monarch, he could have just ended all of that and had a blissful, utopian kind of earthly society. Couldn't he? And yet, when Pilate asked him, "Are you a king?" Jesus said, "Yes, I am a king, but my kingdom is not of this realm. For this I have been born. For this I have been born. I have come to bear witness concerning the truth." And again, he went back to his teaching.
that teaching, which was so all important to Jesus, apparently, that even those social ills and societal things that were so oppressive to so many people, those things were not as important as that teaching that Jesus said he was all about, delivering.
And you know, Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 2, he said, Jesus himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. For you were continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. So here is Jesus who came to the earth and could have done so many good things, and yet he didn't do all those things. But here's what he did. He taught the truth and bore witness to the truth and then allowed them to stretch him out on that cross and hang him up as a sacrifice for the sins of the world. And as Peter says, the sins that we have committed, he bore our sins in his body. By his wounds, we are healed. That's what Jesus deemed as the important thing of his mission. That's what his mission was all about. That was his focus. And none of these other things could even remotely compare in importance to what Jesus was ultimately going to do on that cross. That's what we needed. And that's what Jesus came to save us from. Our own sins, our own separation from God. To turn us around, and as this verse says, to have us die to sin and then live to righteousness. Not just forgive us of our sins in some legal or forensic sense, but no, to transform us so that we are then following his teaching and living righteously. That's what Jesus came to accomplish. Now, with all of that said, brethren, let me talk with you about this. How about some things the New Testament church could have done, but didn't? We've been talking in some recent lessons. I told you I snuck in a series on you about the church. Well, I'm going to continue that. See, I'm still a little sneaky. I'm going to still talk with you, and this lesson really is all about the church and about the work of the New Testament church. When you look at the scriptures, what was that New Testament church doing? What were those congregations of God's people? What were they doing in the name of Jesus Christ? Let me talk with you about some things they were not doing that they could have been focusing in on and doing. They could have been providing entertainment to people. Could have done that. In 1 Corinthians 14, verse 26, Paul there talks about their worship service. And the Corinthian worship service was a cacophony of people talking at the same time and doing what they wanted to do, and Paul just puts a damper on all of that, and he says that all things need to be done for edification. And by edification, he doesn't mean entertainment. No, he's talking about people learning God's truth, learning even what those with spiritual gifts were saying by the power of the Holy Spirit, that people might grow in their knowledge of Jesus and his teaching. It wasn't about entertainment. In fact, when Paul talks about visitors in their congregation, he talks in this very chapter about that person's conscience being pricked. That's what that message that they would hear would need to finally do to that person who was visiting their assembly, to prick their conscience and recognize that, yes, God is here among these people and I'm not right with God. That's what they were trying to accomplish in their worship assemblies. It wasn't just entertainment. That wasn't what they were. Could have been, though. Could have got some interesting speakers, some entertaining joke tellers, but that's not what they did. The New Testament church did not seek to provide health and recreation to people. Could have. You know, in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 27, The Apostle Paul said, I discipline my body daily and make it my slave. But you know, Paul wasn't talking about bodily exercise. I get the impression Paul likes sports. He talks about sports several times in his letters to use as illustrations. He talks about running a race. He talks about boxing matches. You know, he's my kind of guy. But Paul and the New Testament church, they weren't talking about people in increasing their health or doing some things for recreational purposes and enjoyment and all that, and get your cardiovascular system going better and all that. That wasn't what they were about. They could have been doing all those things. They could have focused upon those things. But that's not what the New Testament church was all about. The New Testament church wasn't engaged in politics of that day. Oh, when you look at the New Testament epistles, there are some discussions of things that relate to politics in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 7. You know what Paul tells the Romans there? And they are in the capital city of the empire, and here's the emperor, and it's Emperor Nero, who, by the way, was not the most likable fellow in the world. And not a very good guy. And you know what Paul said? He didn't say what you need to do in your assemblies is see if you can have some political talks and maybe you can come up with enough people who can petition the Roman Senate to overthrow Nero and get another person in as emperor. That's not what Paul wrote. But you know what Paul wrote in Romans 13? He said, you submit to the powers that be. You submit to him. And you represent Jesus Christ to the world as you submit to those political powers. And Paul was a Roman citizen. Paul, on a personal level, obviously was very much interested in Rome and the whole idea of citizenship in Rome. He exercised his Roman citizenship on several occasions. That was an important thing to Paul, but that's not what the New Testament church was about, to get involved in political affairs. The New Testament church, and this to me is so interesting, does not engage in general benevolence. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm talking about general benevolence. The New Testament Christians were extremely benevolent. You see that in Acts chapter 2 and verse 45. After the day of Pentecost and 3,000 had responded to the gospel, and here are all these people who do not live in Jerusalem, and they're all there in need of housing and shelter, food and all that. And the text says that those Christians, they banded together and they even sold property to get money to provide for those who were in need. But it was for those Christians, those disciples of Jesus, those who were baptized into Jesus Christ, that's where they were providing all that benevolence. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and following, and you could also tie in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, Romans 15, verses 25 and following, there's this Jerusalem collection that we read about. That is, all these congregations of the Lord's people in Macedonia and Achaia. It's all during the occasion of Paul's third missionary journey. And those congregations have each one individually agreed and made their own choice to collect money to then send to the needy saints of Jerusalem. And the text says, and it's very clear about it, there's no dispute about it, money for these needy saints, needy Christians. And you read the same thing in Acts chapter 11, where the church at Antioch, as the famine during Claudius's reign began to start, well, they gave of their funds and sent that money to the saints in Jerusalem who were going to be hard hit by that famine. And here's the thing I want us to get from all of this. Despite Jesus' emphasis in his teaching upon being benevolent to those who are in need and showing love for your neighbor and all of that,
Under the apostles' guidance, the New Testament church, when they would pool their money, they were not pooling money to just be a general benevolent society to needy people out there in general. That's not what they were doing. They could have done that. They could have taken up collections to give just to needy non-Christian people out there. Or they could have maybe had some kind of a relief effort of non-Christians and used that to try to get maybe non-Christians to come to their worship service. You know, we have some money. We'll be happy to help you. And that's not what they did. Despite the fact that they could have done that, the text is so explicit that they were tremendously benevolent and they took care of everybody's needs, but it was all those who were in the church. Now, don't think they were exclusivistic about that, because their emphasis was, just like Jesus, on the teaching of the Lord and getting people to accept that teaching of the Lord. But once people accepted Jesus' teaching and became a disciple of Jesus, they were part of this family of people who would sell their property and give to somebody who was in need and do whatever was necessary. But one thing they were not doing, they were not just giving their collected monies as a church. They weren't just giving it to the general public and to solve social ills or social problems or social poverty in the general non-Christian world. No, it was all focusing people's attention upon in Jesus Christ. If you'll make your life right with Jesus, if you'll become a follower of Jesus, that's the relationship you will then have with God. And all of your problems spiritually will be solved, and even your physical necessities, they'll be taken care of. If you're in need, brethren in the Lord Jesus will be there to help you. But it was always focused in that way. And they weren't just providing general benevolence just so that the poverty in Jerusalem in general could be taken care of, or those people who were non-Christians but yet were in need, they could have some funds. That's not what they were doing. The most important thing, in fact, the reason why Jesus came to this earth was to teach his message and die for the sins of the people and make people his disciples. And they used their benevolence in a way that didn't counter that, but instead help people see the priority is the spiritual need you have. And once you take care of that spiritual need and you make your life right with Jesus Christ, hey, we're here to help you. And they always had the attitude of those who were outside of Christ showing kindness and benevolence to them in the sense of calling them to come to Jesus. But you know, in Acts chapter 3, Peter himself said to that lame man who was begging money, he said, silver and gold have I none. But he had something of a spiritual nature he could help that man with, and that's what Peter did. And so what you see in all this is some things the church did not do. They did not rectify social injustices. In fact, in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 18, when Peter is writing there to slaves, who even are slaves of very non-benevolent kind of master, an oppressive kind of master. Peter didn't say, listen, what you need to do is have a political rally and see if we can't overturn slavery in the empire. That's not what he did. What he said is, okay, those of you who are slaves, even if you have an ungodly, oppressive master, you be obedient to that master. Just like you would to the Lord. Show that master that you're being a servant of Jesus Christ going to make you an even better slave. And they weren't suddenly trying to rectify all these social ills in society. They taught people morality and what was right and how you should treat other people. And as slaves and as slave masters obeyed the gospel, that certainly had a trickle-down effect on how everybody behaved. But they weren't out there trying to solve social injustices throughout the world. They were trying to teach people the gospel of Jesus Christ and get people to abide by Jesus' teaching. That's what they were trying to do. And ultimately, they were trying to save people's souls. And I'll tell you one final thing that they did not do. The New Testament church did not use any of these things that we've just been talking about to try to use as a hook to maybe get people who were not interested in the teaching of Jesus to maybe now become interested because they're going to get some money from it, or they're going to get some food or something, or politically or social ills, and we can kind of get them in. They never use that as their attraction. In fact, in John chapter 6, the passage we looked at the beginning of this lesson, when the great crowds whom Jesus had miraculously fed, the 5,000 people, they came the next day, they wanted more of that, and Jesus saw their attitude was not one of really accepting his teaching. You know what Jesus said to them? Not doing a miracle. No. No more. He said, I'm the bread of life. I'm the real bread that you need. Not some physical bread that will feed your belly. You need me and my teaching. Jesus said, that's what you have. And that's what I'm going to give you. When Jesus saw that somehow the people had more of a carnal motive, he didn't cater to that one iota. He appealed to people with the moral and spiritual truth, and those people with a good and honest heart who would be receptive to that moral and spiritual truth, they're the ones who responded. And the New Testament church was the same way. They didn't use any of those earthly things to try to hook people in or attract them to the gospel, try to get them to come to their worship services in that way. Didn't use some kind of a carnal tactic. Didn't use anything. They just used their own example of following Jesus' teaching and trying to urge people to see that there's sin in your life and you need to make yourself right with the one true God and His Son who died and rose on your behalf. When you see all of that, then what you see is that we live in a world that has departed from the New Testament church. We live supposedly in a Christian world with a lot of groups who affirm themselves to be Christians, and yet there's such a difference from what you see the New Testament church doing. Again, the New Testament church focused in upon Jesus and the cross. And that's not what we see in our day and time. Now, what we see are churches. We're talking about revealing God to the world by means of their recreation ministry. We see in our day churches that are talking about having health fairs and community health awareness programs so that you can have greater physical health, and that's the kind of work and activity that churches like this one are engaging in. The New Testament churches weren't focused on that kind of thing. We see in our day the family life ministries, and again, the kind of works that they're engaged in are works that you would engage in and with gymnasiums and sports and, as this photograph indicates, fitness classes, Pilates classes, and all that. And that's what so many churches in our day, that's what they view as a part of their church work. And they have the family life centers that are for that kind of purpose, and that's the focus, and that's where they're trying to appeal to various people. And so you have basketball courts and aerobic training and showers and personal training and weight training and the meeting rooms and the coffee shop and the volleyball. And all of those things are part of the church work. And that's what people are focused in on. That's what churches in our day are focused in on. Or as this First Baptist Church at Lakeside explains, we're providing the best sports experience for every child. That's what they're about. To be fair, that's not all they're about. I'm not saying they never teach anything of Jesus' teaching, but that's what they're focusing in on as a part of their church work. And this is so common. In fact, they explain our mission is to reach people with the news of Jesus Christ through sports, fitness, education, and fellowship activities. And they even quote down at the bottom this passage I quoted from Paul before, 1 Corinthians 9:27, "But I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others
I myself should be disqualified. Paul wasn't talking about physical exercise there, but they've now plucked that out of context to make it apply. And this is how we reach people. And we see churches in our day, and it's a matter of course. It's just commonplace. Where during election times, well, of course you have the politicians come and speak in our church because the churches are very much involved in the political arena. In fact, for a lot of people, that's just what churches are about. The politics of that day and the social issues of that day. And for a lot of people, the reverend, that's how they view Reverend so-and-so. He's a political figure. And whenever you see Reverend so-and-so on the news, well, he's talking politics because that's how people in our day view the work of a church and the work of preachers. And so you have churches that have a drama ministry. And we're ministering to people through drama, and we're showing the gospel of Jesus through drama, and that would be very attractive to people. And so we have a drama ministry. We have a mime ministry. And so we can use mime, and we can show people the gospel, and I'm sure the people are real good at it. But you can't read the New Testament and come away with a picture that that's the way that New Testament churches were trying to teach the gospel of Jesus Christ and appeal to people. Not that there's anything wrong with sports or with mime or with drama per se, but that's not what the New Testament church and its work was all about. You've got karate for Christ. I mean, karate's real big, and we're just trying to get the kids, you know, away from the world. And so you get a bunch of kids that like karate, and so we just focus that. We, you know, pray about with the kids beforehand, and so we now make it a quote Christian activity. And so you got karate for Christ, and that can even bring people into the church. We can get those kids to come to church. I mean, that is the motivation for that. High Point Church, their rock concert that they provide on a weeknight, Tracy Carkey heads to a local spot where the band is known to kick out AC/DC and Journey covers. Before glow sticks were passed around, Carkey, who's 27, joined the crowd swaying to the electric sound. On nights when the fog machine is going full throttle, the scene is like a rock concert. But this is no grungy music venue, this is church. I didn't feel connected at other churches, said Tracy Carkey, until he discovered the High Point Church. For a lot of people, what church is, and what fellowship is, it's not even hidden or anything. It's just put out there very frankly. It's fun and fellowship, sustaining relationships through fun and fellowship. A very important part of our life together at Mitchell's Grove United Methodist Church is our times of fun and fellowship. And boy, do we have those. And that's the appeal. And to a lot of people, what fellowship means, that biblical word fellowship, what it connotes to people is just Christians getting together and doing a whole bunch of fun things. And so we call it fellowship. And to a lot of people, it's, you know, it's coffee and donuts. Because that's how church is presented. We feed the Spirit with our fellowship, coffee and donuts, and so that's... Where do you read the New Testament focusing things like that and having that kind of emphasis? Where does the New Testament church use that kind of approach? Nice jazz concert at the Southern Community Church of Christ, and I throw this in here because I don't want you to think I'm just trying to bash the denominationalists out there. Let me tell you what, there are groups who, at least historically, have identified themselves and still, as this website says, would identify themselves as a church trying to restore New Testament Christianity. And yet, one of the big emphases, one of their big ministries, jazz concert, going to be great. Bring your friends, $5. Come on, let's go. Our vision, the Southern Community Church of Christ is a Christ-centered church where people matter, community matters, spirituality matters, and life matters. We aspire in our church life and program to accept people as they are and help them to become who they are designed to be, generously serve the community, meeting needs and addressing injustice. And it's a very social kind of thing. And don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting they never talk about Jesus or the gospel. Sure they do. But look at how things have become skewed in a way that New Testament churches were never doing. You can have your worship option. You can have the 9:15 contemporary worship service. It provides an opportunity for people of all ages to celebrate life, contemporary music, activities for children, topical input, life-related stories, and more. Lots of interaction, opportunity for involvement. Or you can have the 11 o'clock classic worship, a more liturgical approach to worship with a blend of classic hymns and newer music. Choral music is featured regularly. And then at 6:30 p.m., we have the cafe church service. And it's all about just catering to kind of what people kind of want, what I prefer. That's the real emphasis. And then I'll close. The Grace Place, Duncanville Church of Christ, with their Wayfaring Strangers ministry. You can't read it. You see the picture of the motorcycle. A Christian motorcycle ministry of the Duncanville Church of Christ. And here's what they say. What drives us? We feel the Holy Spirit has called each of us to this ministry in an effort to share Jesus Christ with those willing to accept him. The unique means of accomplishing this through motorcycle riding has allowed us to meet so many people who are just as diverse as the bikes they ride. Thanks for stopping by our place. Make yourself at home and spend a little time getting to know the Wayfaring Strangers. You can read what we are all about. You can also locate our world headquarters or check out some past ride photos. If you'd like to ask us anything, feel free to send us an email. We would be glad to talk to you about Jesus, motorcycles, barbecue, or just about anything. Now, let me tell you what I'm not trying to do. I'm not trying to make fun of people. I'm not trying to act like somehow, oh, well, we at the Valrico Church of Christ, our preacher really just, got down on them, and so we're so much better than they are. That's not what I'm about. That's not what this lesson is about. But this is the world in which we live. And this is a departure from the New Testament concept of things. And it's happened gradually and imperceptibly to so many people. And then when they think of church, when they think of church work, when they use words like ministry or fellowship, these are the things they think of. It is a shift away from the New Testament. It's a shift away from what New Testament churches were doing and what they were not doing. And New Testament churches could have done all these things, could have done them all, and didn't. Because New Testament churches recognized it was about Jesus and the cross. That's what it was about. And you don't try to hook people in by using as bait something other than Jesus and the cross. In fact, the kind of bait you use is going to determine the kind of fish you're going to catch. And they were looking for people who were looking for Jesus. And that's what New Testament churches, and Jesus himself in his ministry illustrated and showed the way where the real focus is supposed to be. And so I say all that to help us understand, not for us to pat ourselves on the back or look down at other people. That's not the point of this. But I say all this because this is part of glaring error and glaring departure. And we've got so many people in so many churches, and a lot of them would affirm themselves to be New Testament churches of Christ, and yet they're so affected by this kind of secular, social gospel kind of thinking. And it's not what the New Testament reveals. I thank you for listening to me this morning. We're going to talk a little bit more about this kind of thing and kind of some things
this evening we will talk a little bit more about this. And talk this evening about what are some things that have prompted our American society to be where it is now in what church means. Those of you who are younger, this maybe is what you think is just kind of what church means to people. It wasn't always this way. This is a much more recent event, even in American culture. This extent of a social, gospel, secularized kind of church concept. And so we'll talk a little bit this evening about some of those factors that have produced this situation that we have in our world today. But I hope what I've said this morning can enlighten us to some of these things and make us think about some of these things and about some of the dangers that are there. And maybe, even in some of our own minds, maybe we've been affected by some of the same kind of thinking that certainly was not the way Jesus approached things and was not the way the New Testament church did. If you're here this morning, you need to respond to the gospel of Jesus. We sure would love to help you do that. We're all imperfect people. If you're an imperfect person, guess what? You're just like us, but you need the Lord. And if you need to make your life right with Him, whatever be that need, to be baptized into Him, whatever be your need, let that be known. While together we stand and sing this song of encouragement.